Jeffrey Stone is author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. Closing out discussion of the Civil War, I'm curious if you could describe how the Post-Sedition Act view of free speech differed from that following the Civil War, and how they differed in influencing activities 10 or 20 years immediately following.
Well, in both of these periods, and indeed frequently throughout American history, after the nation goes through a period of excessive restriction of civil liberties, there is a sense of reflection and often of recognizing that we have acted unduly harshly in an intemperate manner, and therefore in a sense of regret. And both after 1800 and again after the Civil War, and indeed after each of these periods, the government essentially retrenches and the public becomes more aware of the tendency to abuse the rights of individuals in these circumstances, not only to restrict them, where restriction may be legitimate or authorized, but to abuse them. And there is a sense of, okay, well, we've learned from that experience, we won't do it again. But the problem is lessons don't last very long because people change, that is, generations change, and even if one generation remembers the lesson it learned, it doesn't always get passed down effectively to the next generation. But in the period after the Civil War, up until World War I, there was essentially no federal legislation regulating political speech in the United States. Indeed, from the Sedition Act of 1798 until World War I, there was no federal legislation because, as we saw in the Civil War, there was no legislation. And except for the efforts to restrict speech primarily by military authorities during the Civil War, there were really no significant federal government efforts to restrict political speech from 1798 until 1917, which is a period of 125 years.
And in 1917, following a declaration of war that then-President Woodrow Wilson sought against Germany, he proposed the Espionage Act of 1917, the first legislation since the Sedition Act against disloyal expression here in the U.S. It also sort of coincided with the Supreme Court, really for the first time, trying to get a grip on the First Amendment. And that was one of the things that was most surprising to me, is that there was so much U.S. history that occurred, and the Supreme Court never really looked at this issue.
Right. It was not until 1919 that the Supreme Court seriously had to confront the meaning of the First Amendment. There are really two reasons for that surprising fact. The first is that, as we discussed earlier, the First Amendment did not apply to the states, and so all of the various regulations that the states and cities may have had about where speech can take place and how loud it can be and whether obscenity can be regulated and whether libel can be regulated, none of those issues was within the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, and the court didn't regard those questions as federal constitutional questions until after World War I. So that whole avenue of free speech issues simply was not thought relevant to the Supreme Court. And the second reason, of course, is that after the Sedition Act of 1798, there was no federal legislation that directly restricted political discourse. And during the Civil War, the Supreme Court didn't rule on any of the decisions made by various lower court judges or by military officials. So it wasn't until the legislation enacted during World War I that the Supreme Court really began in a serious way to enter the picture in terms of interpreting the First Amendment. Wilson's situation is an interesting one because he was reelected in 1916 on the platform that he kept us out of war. And most Americans at the time had no particular interest in involving the United States in the war in Europe. It had already proved itself to be extraordinarily bloody with huge, devastating casualty lists. And for the most part, Americans wanted no part of it. What finally dragged the United States into the war was the issue of freedom of the seas. The United States was trading actively with England and France during the war, and the Germans did not much like the idea of American shipping bringing armaments, munitions, and other supplies to England and France, while at the same time, because Germany had so little access to the sea, the Allies were able to block American shipping to Germany just by mining a couple of rivers or harbors. So the Germans, to sort of reciprocate in order to prevent the United States from providing goods to England and France, but not to Germany, since the United States was a neutral, it essentially used submarine warfare and announced that if American shipping enters the waters of England and France, they will be vulnerable to being sunk by German U-boats. Wilson, who believed deeply in the freedom of the seas and in international law and the right of neutrals to trade openly, if it wished to, with the belligerents, regarded this activity on the part of the Germans as an extraordinary violation of the international premises, and he sought a declaration of war largely on that basis. Many Americans were not terribly enthusiastic about this. Many Americans basically said, well, who's the beneficiary of this freedom of the seas? It's basically munitions manufacturers, capitalists, exporters of armaments and other supplies, but it's the common man who's going to die on the battlefields. Do we really have a vital interest here? Why can't we just stop trading with England and France and stand by and let them continue their own war? So there was a lot of opposition to World War One, and Wilson therefore needed a way, or felt he needed a way, to prevent that opposition from being voiced. So in proposing the Espionage Act of 1917, and then a year later in proposing the Sedition Act of 1918, he sought very powerful legislation that would effectively make it a crime for any person to criticize the government, the war, the draft, the flag, the Constitution, or the uniform of the United States. In those two pieces of legislation, Wilson effectively got what he wanted.
On page 183... and I don't know if this is a quote from someone else or if this is something that you wrote, quote, "The dominant mood of the public was repressive to a degree that is hard for contemporary Americans to imagine." Now, the context of this was no limitations, more or less, on dissent since the Civil War, the populist movement, the anarchist syndicalist movement, and many, many other movements, the communists, the socialists, all had their own little papers, and there was really vibrant political discourse. And it's amazing to me that that quote could still be accurate given the state in which we find ourselves today. Is that something you wrote? Is that quoted from elsewhere?
It is something I wrote. And there's really no comparison between the mindset of the American people in 1917, 1919, to what exists today. Partly that's true because we have almost 90 years of learning under our belts that I think has made this society more acutely aware of the value of not only free speech, but other civil liberties. But more importantly, there were two factors that added to the environment of a war that exacerbated the problem. One is the fact that by the time of World War One, the United States had gone through a huge immigration, and there was a sharp differentiation between people who regarded themselves as true Americans and this enormous influx of Eastern and Southern Europeans who were regarded as alien and foreign and untrustworthy, and who tended to be the ones who were more associated with many of the various movements that you identified a moment ago. And so there was a sense on the part of many mainstream Americans that those people don't have and should not have the rights that real American citizens have. So that exacerbated the problem in World War One. And the second factor that exacerbated it substantially is that Wilson, facing the dilemma he had, that is needing a public that would not only not criticize the war, but also needing a public that would affirmatively support the war, that would buy war bonds, that would not resist the draft, as many people had during the Civil War, to avoid the kind of draft riots that had happened during the Civil War. He needed desperately to win the American public to support the war. To do this, he created something called the Committee on Public Information, which was very explicitly a wartime propaganda arm of the federal government. Led by a man named George Creel, it was intended to produce a flood of pamphlets, leaflets, movies, editorials, lectures, posters, all of which were designed to generate a hatred of all things German and a suspicion and hatred of anyone who might be in any way seen as possibly disloyal to the American cause. So what the Wilson administration did was to really poison the goodwill of American society by trying to create suspicion of disloyalty and by dividing Americans against one another, in a way intended to rally the vast majority of Americans to support the war, partly because of the fear of enemies within, and partly because of their sense that if they lost this war, that there could be even a revolution in the United States by these masses of unwashed immigrants. So as a consequence of that, the mindset during World War One was a particularly ugly one. There were many instances of individuals who were tarred and feathered, several who were hung, many who were beaten by mobs, simply because they were not wholeheartedly in support of the war in Europe. And in enforcing the Espionage Act and Sedition Act, the government was ruthless in a way that is unparalleled in American history. We mentioned earlier that in the Sedition Act of 1798, someone like Matthew Lyon was sentenced to 4 months in prison. During the Civil War, those who were imprisoned were generally imprisoned for only a matter of weeks or a few months. Under the Espionage and Sedition Acts of 1917 and 1918, individuals who were convicted, and there were over 2,000 prosecutions, were typically sentenced to prison terms of 10 to 20 years in jail. So this was an extremely draconian effort on the part of the federal government to suppress any and all opposition to the war. And to give you a sense of how aggressive the effort at suppression was at the time, the people who were prosecuted under this legislation ranged from the obscure to the politically prominent. At one end, an example is a young woman named Molly Steimer, who was a 20-year-old Russian-Jewish emigre who was arrested for throwing some leaflets off a rooftop in the Lower East Side of New York, leaflets that were one side in English and one side in Yiddish that were opposing the war effort. She was sentenced to prison for 10 years and then deported as a result of that activity. And on the other extreme, Eugene Debs, who in 1912 was the Socialist Party candidate for President of the United States and received over 1 million votes, or 6% of all the votes cast in that election, was convicted under the war legislation for giving a speech in Ohio in which, only by innuendo, he criticized the Wilson administration and admired the courage of those who refused the draft. And he was sentenced to 10 years in prison as a result of that speech. So it was a period of extraordinary repression. And one of the things about repression is that it breeds repression. And so what Wilson was able to do was not only to suppress his opponents and his critics, but to do so in a way that whipped up a kind of frenzy in the American people.
Jeffrey, I hate when this happens, but that's our hour, and I didn't even get through World War I. I really hope that I can give you a call back sometime and discuss the second half of your thoroughly researched and exhaustive book, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime.
It would be my pleasure.
Okay, great. Because we didn't even get to talk about Schenck v. U.S., where the so-in-vogue phrase, clear and present danger, actually comes from. But,
right, and fire in a crowded theater.
Yeah, the fire in the crowded theater, all the World War II stuff, the internment, COINTELPRO, HUAC, Martin Dees, the Smith Act, J. Edgar Hoover, and on and on and on and on and on. But we will have you back, and we will get to that second half of the book. I have been speaking with Jeffrey Stone, author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.